All I meant was like, if EA is a basis of C2, then these are just the elementary matrices, the matrix with one in the AB entry and zero elsewhere. And if we take EA tensor EB, the basis of C2 tensor C2, then row EB1, E or ES is, I just act this guy on the first factor. Whereas row AB2, I act by this matrix on the second factor. And P is a permutation matrix. So it's easy to see that P is equal to the sum or S row or S one row S or two. Because if I apply this to something like EA tensor EB, well, here I'm going to turn EA into ES with the delta or A. And here I'll have a delta SB. So that's this, the first factor will then be EB, and the second factor will be EA. So it's some kind of silly computation with these formulas to check that P has this form.
So the last two lines, is that matrix multiplication? Or
which last two lines? Here?
No, on the left side. There?
No. Over here?
Yeah.
No, so these are like, this is an operator and this is a state.
Yeah, and that's acting on the first
factor. Right. Yeah.
And I just don't, you know, it seems like from the way that you define row up there,
mm-hmm.
they're just delta.
It's a matrix with one of the AB entry. So Tibor pointed out these are, of course, not in SU2. So strictly speaking, when we write down these monotomy matrices, because the A and B indices are 1 from 1 to 2, so this is a 2 by 2 matrix, so there's 4 independent entries as opposed to 3 independent entries for SU2. It turns out that these monotomy matrices satisfy a constraint, which is a version of having determinant 1, which means there's actually only 3 independent entries. That's why it's more like SU2.
Sorry for... When you write row AB acting on EA is equals to EB,
yeah.
You don't mean an implied sum then, right?
No, I don't. Sorry.
That's the important thing. So
yes, I should have. It would have been better drawn like this.
Delta
A or. Thank you.
Okay.
So I was wondering if anybody noticed that the computation you did was like pretty much the same as the computation you did in the first tutorial. In the first tutorial, you looked at some OR matrix. And you asked that it was the identity. Times the identity plus g of z times the permutation operator, this operator, and we try to solve. Sorry, we ask that OR solves the Yang-Baxter equation, and by some manipulations, you determine that like fz over g of z, you have some constraint on this ratio. So that are z 0, 1 over 0, 1 over the factor. So the Jahn-Baxter equation applies a constraint on the ratio of these two functions. Now, what you were doing in the tutorial yesterday was like almost exactly the same thing. Yesterday's tutorial, we had two particles coming in, and we had some S, put a dotted line. Here are the monodromy matrix, and I wanted this to be equal to now the form of the monodromy matrix. It's a product of something here and something here. So this equation is almost is exactly the Jahn-Baxter equation. Except that the things we're putting at the three vertices are not necessarily the same. Except we know what happens for this kind of vertex. We know what happens for this vertex, and then we determine what happens for this vertex. So it's really the same calculation. So what the result of the calculation we did was that this matrix, the scattering matrix, is equal to some function times the Ohr matrix, which we introduced right at the beginning. And this function is not determined there's a name for it it's called a form factor. So Tiber also said that like people would have questions about the course in general. There.
Like I think some of us were wondering that how like how you know the two parts of the courses are kind of like how they're related, like you know, the first part
being
statistical mechanical stuff and all the
field
theory stuff. And I guess we can some kind of, you know, that would my that's the impression I got, but you know, I'm not sure about the more precise questions.
Right. Wait, and so that question is a bit, it's like slightly tricky to answer well. So one relationship is this kind of formula relationship. In the continuum field theories, the scattering matrices satisfy the same equations that the Boltzmann weights satisfy in the vertical in the statistical mechanical models, and like they are the same over just some prefactor. So that's a very formal relationship. But you can take it a little further, and you know, you draw some diagram of scattering particles, and you compute them exactly. You compute the way the result of particles coming in and going out, just like you would in a physical mechanical system, by summing over intermediate states and putting the Boltzmann weights, right, the scattering matrix at every vertex. So that tells us that algebraically they look very similar. I think it's a lot trickier to give a precise physical relationship. In the literature, it's argued, I don't really understand these arguments. It's argued that the continuum limit of these vertex models will become these integrable field theories we've been studying. For example, it's believed that the continuum limit of the sixth vertex model would become the signal model on the two sphere, which we wrote down at some stage.
These four factors are determined in some conditions by the bootstrap conditions, is that correct?
I don't understand this story really well. Like the poles of the form factors tell you about the masses of like other tell you about the particle spectrum and stuff, I think.
If you have some guess on the mass spectrum, you can determine its form factor
I think so, and there's a unitarity constraint as well on the form factors. So yeah, I mean in examples people can figure them out. I don't understand that story.
On how to go like the other way around from like, so we start with a Lax operator, right? And then we figure out that the theory is integrable and blah blah blah. We can write the conservative current and so on and so on. How do you go the other way around? Like if you have a theory with a higher spin conservative charge,
yes.
How do you build the Lax operator in general if the theory is not of the form Cairo, Plazetti Cairo?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't see why having a higher spin conserved charge implies on like first principles that there must be a Lax matrix. It seems that like in most examples of theories with a higher spin conserved charge, that there is a Lax matrix, but the connection between I don't know how to build it from that.
But it's true that the theory is going to be integrable if you have this higher spin conserved.
Yes, I mean the word integrable. It's kind of slightly elastic, but having a higher spin conserved charge implies that there's no particle production. And therefore the scattering matrix will satisfy the Yang-Max termination. I don't see why it implies that there's a Lax matrix. Although it might. Any other questions? Yeah.
Could you summarize how we can determine if the theory is integrable? Like the condition we've seen of integrability.
So the condition we've been using, but mostly because I understand it the best, is at the semi-classical level in perturbation theory, that there's a Lax operator. Once you work non-perturbatively, you want to have the only thing you can really talk about then will be the monodromy matrix built from that Lax operator. That monodromy matrix should be thought of as a conserved line defect. So it's let's say topological and conserved. Line defect. So I can draw a line in my theory, and maybe I can make it wiggle if I want to. And I can put incoming and outgoing states at the end of this line, and I get an operator acting on the Hilbert space. So I'm really changing my theory along this line, and conserved means I can shift it around, but topological means that I can also bend it without any effect. And because it depends on Z, we get, you know, infinite number of... So from the point of view I've been taking, this is what meant by integrable. Other people, I mean, I think if you ask Samuel Rodrikov, he would say integrable means having a higher spin conserved local operator. And the connection between these two properties is a bit obscure. Any other questions? So maybe I'll, it's okay, I'll, so today and tomorrow I wanted to talk a little bit about how to understand these structures from the point of view of four-dimensional gauge theory. So I'll just start by writing down the Lagrangian for the 4D gauge theory, and it'll take us a little bit of work to make the connection with the integrable lattice models and the integrable field theories. We will get there in later today or tomorrow. So the 4D gauge theory we're interested in has a usual gauge field. It lives on, say, R2 times C, where the coordinates here are WW bar, and Z. And I'm writing this one as C because everything is going to be holomorphic on this plane. And the fundamental field is a gauge field as usual. Which is a one-form valued in GLM. And the Lagrangian we're going to consider is not the Yang-Mills Lagrangian, but it's a version of the Schoen-Simons Lagrangian. Here by CS, I mean the Schoen-Simons 3 form. We can expand this out as so it's kinetic term involves only one derivative, because it's ADA. And the cubic term, and there's this cubic term, which is the interaction. So let's analyze a little bit what this. What the properties of this Lagrangian. So firstly, we note that there's extra gauge symmetry. As well as usual gauge symmetry, this is the usual generator of infinitesimal gauge transformations. There's a second kind of transformation. This leaves the action invariant. where eta is an adjoint valued scalar. The reason is very simple. If I perform this transformation, I'll change these guys by something involving dz, and dz wedge dz is zero, the algebra of form, the algebra of differential forms, so the Lagrangian will not change. So by using the second gauge transformation, we can gauge fix with respect to the second gauge transformation and ask that the z component of A vanishes. So now A has only three components. So it's a partial gauge field.
Please repeat why the transformation makes Lagrangian invariant.
What was?
Why is the Lagrangian invariant and the Lagrangian transformation can be replaced, please?
Right, because in these expressions, we're implicitly using the wedge of differential forms. And dz wedge dz is zero. Because like one forms are treated as fermionic variables. So, you know, faced with some Lagrangian, maybe probably the first thing one should do is analyze the equations of motion. So the equations of motion are varying gives dz a dA plus half AA equals zero. In other words, dz times the field strength. So expanding this out, now since A only has three components, this equation does not tell us anything about the components of the field strength involving z. So we find Fw, w bar, A equals zero, Fw, z bar, A equals zero, and F W bar Z bar A equals zero. So we think a little about what these equations mean geometrically. The first equation says if we just restrict to a fixed value of Z, I have a connection in the WW bar plane, which is flat. Well, the other equations, if we were in Lorentzian signature, so we should treat z bar as being an actual direction, then we would have some flatness conditions along three directions of the four-dimensional spacetime. But in Euclidean signature, we should interpret these as slightly differently. Along these two directions, we have a flat connection. On the z bar plane, we have a holomorphic bundle, and the parallel transport along the W plane preserves that holomorphic bundle. So I only say that for people who have more of a background in differential geometry, otherwise it might not actually be a helpful point of view. Okay, so let me now try to start discussing the connection between this field theory and integral models of both types. So first with the vertex models. So we're going to be interested in Wilson lines is theory. R. There is usual, given by the sum, the path ordered exponential of A along some path. So these are only gauge invariant for a path in the WW bar plane where Z is constant. So the reason is when we do consider this path ordered exponential, we pick up the component of the gauge field, which is tangent to the Wilson line. So if the line moves in the z plane, then this path ordered exponential of A must involve the z component of the connection. Because, for example, if you move the real value of z, it will involve az plus az bar to pick up the real value. And so it cannot be gauge invariant under the second kind of gauge transformations. Okay, is that clear?
Why can't it move the z-bar plane?
Right, well, if you were in Lorentzian signature, so that z and z-bar were coordinates of the light cone, then it could. But in Euclidean signature, you can't move in the z-bar plane without also moving in the z-plane. Because if this is the complex plane, if I have a path, it's always described by, the tangent vector to this path is some real vector. So it's always a linear combination of az and az bar, of az and az bar. Right. So the tangent vector to this path might be, say, dx plus b dy, where a and b are real, whereas del z is del x minus I del y. Del z bar, del x plus I del y. So to get A and B real, I must have a linear combination of them both. Make sense? No.
So I just parameterize with z and z bar, and then surely I could just move the z bar plane.
Use
x and y instead of z and z bar,
which
just rotated my like.
Right. Okay. Yes. So suppose you use x and y instead of z and z bar, and you wanted to have a path moving in the z bar plane. Now, in the x and y coordinates, this means your path, which is a function of t, takes on imaginary values of x and y. But that's not a path in the plane. That's a path in the complexified plane. And if you think about the complexified plane, the Euclidean plane is where x and y are real. The Lorentzian plane is where x is real and y is imaginary. So if you have a path like you described, it will not really live in the Euclidean plane, it will live in the Lorentzian. Actually, this kind of thing, like.
Sorry, can you, are lines invariant, or you're considering lines and not loops, right?
They can be either.
And are the lines gauge invariant?
They're gauge invariant as long as they're infinite, and we consider fields which decay rapidly at infinity.
Can you clarify again why moving in this plane is part?
Yeah. Okay, so suppose I have a line, so I've drawn a T on the line. And I have F1 of T, F2 of T are the X and Y coordinates. I'm going to ignore the W direction, whereas Z is X plus IY. Well, then the one form that we integrate on the line is AX of two of T times F1 prime of T dt plus AY 1 of T So all I'm doing is I'm taking AX dx plus AY dy and substituting in X is F1, Y is F2, and I get this expression. Now, claim that this must always involve AZ. Z because AX is like a half of AZ plus AZ bar, AY is a half AZ minus AZ bar, 1/2i, sorry. So if we substitute in, and we use the fact that like F1 of T, F2 of T are real, then there's no way to cancel the coefficient of AZ that appears here using the coefficient of AZ that appears there. So like this factor of 1/2i spoils us, because we would have to have the derivative of F2 involving an I to cancel. We can't. If F2 involved an I, then this path would not be a path in real Euclidean space. It would be.
Mm-hmm. Actually, I'm a bit confused. You're saying that if you have a Wilson line that goes that moves in the Z plane, then that is in contradiction with our gauge fixing condition, right?
Well, it's if we don't impose the gauge fixing condition, we would say it's not gauge invariant. I think that's the best way to understand it. Because the gauge transformations shift AZ. So the main first main claim is that if we put a Wilson line at z z0 in the x direction, and another one that equals z1 in the y direction, then we can draw this picture. Note these Wilson lines don't actually cross. So the blackboard is equal to the W plane. Oh no, I realize I made a really terrible mistake. I used X and Y for both the real part of Z and the real part of W. Let's call these something else. U and V. And W is U plus IV. So then I can put a state. I can put states at the end. I need to put states at the end of the Wilson lines, because I need to have, when I do the path ordered exponential, I need to say what I do with the bottom and the top. And I can consider the scattering matrix, where I take two incoming states and they scatter off each other. And in the middle, they also exchange gauge fields. The claim is that this scattering of states is equal to the OR matrix the one we've been using, say, if we take GLN, our gauge field is in GLN and is equal to 2, this will be the 6 vertex OR matrix. Let's see. Does everybody understand this statement? No. No. Okay.
Can you just repeat what's this?
So the claim is that I take these Wilson lines with these incoming and outgoing states, and I compute the partition function in the presence of these Wilson lines, the answer will be the OR matrix. So you should think of it as incoming states scattering off the middle. But really concretely, this Wilson line is some path-ordered exponential. This guy is some other path-ordered exponential. What the claim is, if I write down, the path-ordered exponential involves a bunch of gauge fields, I connect them by Feynman diagrams in an arbitrary way, the result will be the OR matrix. I mean, this is how one would do this computation. You write down the path-ordered exponential, and you write down all the Feynman diagrams where the legs go to the gauge field So maybe to convince you of this statement, so to convince you of the statement, well, there are two things I like to try to argue to convince you of why it's true. Firstly, if we have things like this, why should they satisfy the Young-Baxter equation? That would be a pretty good evidence because the Young-Baxter equation is a very strong equation and it will strongly constrain whatever the result of the scattering process is. And the second thing we can do is we can do some leading order computation. So firstly, why does the Young-Baxter equation hold for these scattering processes? So the answer is if you consider a Wilson line at, say, a fixed value at, say, z equals z naught, and in the u direction, at a fixed value of v, say v equals v naught, something like this. Then, yeah.
Sorry, just to be sure, you're computing though with the expectation value of two Wilson lines, right?
Yes, with boundary conditions. So I want to claim that this Wilson line is a conserved quantity, just like the ones we've seen before. That if I move it horizontally, it does not change. This is conserved. And the reason is, this is because f u v of a is equal to zero. So the curvature in this plane of the back blackboard of the gauge field vanishes. So moving, shifting v zero in other words, if we shift this guy a little bit, the variation in the Wilson line will vanish once we impose the equations in motion. Another way to make the same argument is there's some topological symmetry. The theory is really topological in this UV thing. You notice that this argument is the one we've used before for the Lax matrix, except it's playing something slightly different about it in this context, because the gauge field A is you know, a fundamental dynamical field of the model. This is slightly different than the Lax matrix formalism. Now, once we know this, the Young-Baxter equation is obvious because these lines are conserved. You can take three Wilson lines. And because this diagonal one is conserved, I can move it a small amount and nothing will change. Now, further, although the way I've drawn it, it looks like the Wilson lines intersect, that was only because I can only draw in two dimensions. There's another two dimensions, and they all live at different points in that two dimensions, so they actually don't touch. Because they don't touch, there's not going to be any singularity when they cross each other. Okay. So, any questions about this? I know it's very formal, but it follows almost obviously from formal properties of the theory. So the other part of an argument for why this must be the Orr matrix is to do the leading order computation of when two Wilson lines exchange a single gluon. So let me explain how to do that computation. And then we can stop, and next time I'll try to say how the integral models we've been studying fit into this context. So we can introduce a loop expansion parameter. H bar. So that let me see if I can get it. Let me do the one for SU2. So it's the identity matrix plus H bar over Z where EA is an orthonormal basis with the Lie algebra of the gauge group. So I want to reproduce this by a gauge theory analysis. So in this particular case, every power of H bar will be accompanied by a corresponding power of Z. So you can derive this formula just by like replacing Z by Z over H bar and expanding, picking up the leading terms. In the case of SU2, these will be the Pauli matrices.
Matrix in this case is the scattering matrix. In the diagram, it's basically it's somehow computing the interaction between the two Wilson lines, right?
Yes, exactly. states at the end. So I want to...
Is that the amplitude then, or...?
You can think of it as the amplitude where I chose a boundary condition at infinity, or if I want to break up infinity into incoming and outgoing, it's a transition amplitude where I take two states at infinity and they scatter and become two states on the other side. So here I just mean I want to identify this scattering amplitude in gauge theory with the standard formulas in integral models. This is the formula you will find for the six vertex or matrix.
I'm a bit confused about this interpretation as scattering because we don't have any states in the fundamental representation, right?
Well, if I just took the gauge theory itself, the gauge theory itself turns out to be very massive. So the Hilbert space of the gauge theory is not interesting. I only get an interesting Hilbert space when I introduce these Wilson lines. And the end of the Wilson line changes the Hilbert space of the gauge theory. If I have a fundamental Wilson line, I will pick up a copy of the fundamental representation sitting at the end of the Wilson line. That's what's happening here. So the Wilson line, I mean, the path-ordered exponential formula doesn't really capture everything the Wilson line does. It's really a defect which changes every aspect of the theory, including the Hilbert space. Okay, so how do we do this computation? So I want to compute the exchange of a single gluon. So I'm going to be a little lazy and use a particularly nice gauge, which makes this computation quite easy. So we have maybe I should finish this next time, but let me get it started. So we'll choose the following gauge. So what's happening is the natural Lorentz gauge would be del U A U plus del V A V plus del Z A Z bar equals 0. This is the most natural gauge for working with this theory, but this one arises when I scale up the UV plane. We rescale the UV plane. We find. So in the limit, when the UV plane is treated as much bigger than the Z plane, the gauge becomes this because the coefficient of these two terms becomes very small. So in this gauge, the propagator is so 1/2πiz. Times PA, answer A, times Okay, so I think I'll have to come back to this point next time and explain why this is a complicator. The main reason is, you know, the equation, the propagator is something which when I plug in the kinetic term, I'll get a delta function. In the kinetic term, I have a d by dz bar. D by dz bar here will produce a delta function in the z-plane. There's already a delta function in the other directions. I should put this aside, z1 and z2. And once you know this is the propagator, this propagator is just a delta function, you find that there's an interaction just at this point, proportional to 1 over z. So I'll come back to this next time.
Why is the propagator a twofer?
You can think of the propagator as a two-point function where I have two gauge fields.
I see.
And gauge field is a one-form.